Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, our series on the Rim Fire continues. We'll also find out why kids in Firebaugh are playing near the San Joaquin River once again this summer, as a new program helps to bring them healthy lifestyles and a healthy respect for the river. That and the brewing debate over immigrant health care here in Fresno County. But first, we go to our developing story of the day, the Junction Fire, sparked late Monday afternoon near Highway 41 and Highway 49 in the community of Oakhurst in Madera County. 13,000 homes and businesses are now under a mandatory evacuation order. Another 2,500 are under an advisory evacuation. The fire has burned now over 1,200 acres. And here to tell us more is FM89's Ezra David Romero, who was at the evacuation center in Corscold on Monday night. Ezra, welcome.
Well, thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Ezra, what do we know right now about the Junction Fire? You were at the fire scene late last night, just came down the mountain from Oakhurst back to Fresno to our studios. What do we know about the fire as it's burning right now?
Well, the fire started almost in downtown Oakhurst on the 41 and the 49. So it happened late, early afternoon, and pretty immediately air tankers are out there dropping retardant out there. People were lining up the highway, upper 41, to see the flames. And I could see them on my way home. You saw them crawling up the mountains.
And the fire started on one side of 41, then crossed
and
over,
jumped over
to the other side. We have some audio from CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Chris Christopher we'll listen to right now.
The fires moved very rapidly up through this area with the wind conditions we had today, you know, with those California drought conditions that we're faced with. You know, the fire was moving faster than we could get firefighters in the area to try to get ahead of it.
Now, we were on the air yesterday afternoon doing news updates on the station, and immediately an evacuation center was set up at the Oakhurst Community Center. But within an hour almost, that evacuation center moved. What was the situation there?
Yeah, so it moved. People were in Oakhurst, and they had to go basically around the mountain on some mountain roads to get to Corscold, the new evacuation center. And there was about 150 people at the beginning when I got there, and about 250 at the end. So people were lining themselves in cots and going to go to sleep for the night.
Yes, and that center had to move because of its proximity to the fire as the fire grew and spread rapidly. You spoke to a number of people. Tell us about the first group that we're going to hear from.
Yeah, I spoke with a woman named Raylene Lampson. She was there with a dog she was house sitting or pet sitting for. She was in the Oakhurst Mobile Home Park. We'll hear from her now.
I was pet sitting for these people that lived right across the street from the fire where it first kind of started. They were on their way home, but I couldn't get a hold of them, so I just grabbed the dog and ran when they came and said, "You've got to evacuate now."
Now, we also had tourists who were in the area as well. Hotels along Highway 41 were evacuated, and you also talked with some people who are in the area from out of town to see Yosemite.
Yeah, I met some people from New Jersey. They were just coming down the hill from Yosemite, and they said they saw the signs and they couldn't even get to their hotel, and they wanted their clothes.
We just watched the smoke for quite some while, and then as it progressed, then the sheriff came by and said, "Evacuate and come to Corscold," and that's why we're all here. But outside of that, we know no more. Got a blanket and a pillow. I guess that's all that's necessary.
That actually was Rhonda Schmidt. She's a resident of Oakhurst since 1964. She lives in the Oakhurst Mobile Home Park. She was evacuated early on, too. She got two calls from the sheriff's department. But now we're going to hear from Teresa Amberger and her family.
We were just about 3 minutes away from the hotel, and the police were stopping us. We didn't know why, and I noticed smoke in the distance, but we didn't know, and I called the hotel up, and they had said, "Oh, you didn't know." She's like, "We evacuated. I got to go," and she hung up.
What was the mood like in Oakhurst last night after you were at the evacuation center? I understand you went into the town up to the roadblocks that they have set up. This is just a year after the Rim Fire and a year after the government, less than a year after the government shutdown of Yosemite last fall. What's the mood like in this tourist community of Oakhurst right now, just south of Yosemite?
Well, as I was driving down the hill, you basically Oakhurst is in a canyon. On one side is burning, the other side is the highway coming in. As you come down, people are lining the streets just to get a glimpse of the fire. But the mood in the town was kind of frantic. It seemed like tourists were just trying to get any information they could. McDonald's was totally full. Starbucks was full. People were just hungry for information, and they were asking me as a reporter, what do you know?
And certainly so, and we're going to continue to follow the story. Stay with Valley Public Radio for updates throughout the day. We also have an update on the fast-moving Way Fire, which is burning at this moment in the Sequoia National Forest in Kern County near Wofford Heights. That blaze, which was first reported on Monday at around 3 o'clock, has now scorched over 3,100 acres. We know structures have been destroyed, as have been destroyed in the Junction Fire as well. Road closures are in effect on Highway 155 at Sierra Vista, Adams, Mountain View, Rock Haven, and Sargent Lane. The evacuation center is located at the Kern Valley High School in Lake Isabella on Erskine Creek Road. The American Red Cross is on hand at the evacuation center to care for evacuees. And again, stay with Valley Public Radio for updates on both the Way Fire and the Junction Fire here in Central California. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. While the Junction Fire continues to burn south of Yosemite, we now turn our attention to a fire that took place exactly a year ago, the Rim Fire. And our special series on that blaze continues now. Just 2 days after our piece on the lack of progress in the Rim Fire investigation aired, federal authorities announced a grand jury indictment against Keith Matthew Emerald, the bow hunter accused of starting the massive blaze. But while we now know more about how the fire began, residents in the mountain communities affected by the blaze are still asking questions about how the fire was fought. It's one of the issues the Tuolumne County Board of Supervisors wants to bring up in a full congressional hearing on the matter. So just how did the Rim Fire grow so big so fast? And could authorities have done something differently to prevent the fire from destroying over 400 square miles of the Sierra? We sent our Ezra David Romero and Deanna Aguilera to the fire zone to talk with those who were on the front lines.
3 weeks ago, Wesley Wills had a flashback.
We were driving down Big Oak Flat Road and just saw it blowing up again. You could see flame lengths of over 100 feet. It was really a tense moment.
He's talking about the El Portal fire that burned just miles from the Rim Fire burn area. Wills, an archaeologist and a firefighter for the National Park Service, pitched his tent at Drew Meadow, the same place where the Rim Fire base camp was set up.
How's it going, guys? Good, how you doing?
Last year, the camp hosted 5,000 firefighters, and Will says it was like a makeshift city.
An angry man's cook is not better than a happy man.
I caught up with him at the end of the workday, just in time for dinner.
So last year, the Rim Fire, I've been around fires for a long time. I've been evacuated multiple times, and I'd never seen anything that large, so I was really worried about it.
But now this year, with fires like the El Portal and the French Fire that burned in the Sierra Nevada, people are wondering why the Rim Fire got so big, what lessons can be learned from the blaze, and whether the fire could have been handled differently or contained earlier.
I spoke with Chris Scow.
I was here the day the Rim Fire started and lived the entire thing.
He's the fire chief for the Stanislaw National Forest and the guy who was leading the Rim Fire containment effort. He remembers the first 3 days of the firefight as if they were yesterday.
One of the air attack platforms that was flying the Boyd Fire picked up a smoke in the lower Clavey and flew over to it. We kind of knew immediately it was in a bad spot.
The ravine is steep and isolated. Weather conditions were historically dry, and the canyon is a dangerous place to send firefighters. Scow immediately began the effort to contain the fire, but was hesitant to send a hand team in early on because a firefighter died in the canyon during a blaze in the same area in 2004.
The most safe, most efficient way to fight a fire is to secure the anchor of it, work up the flanks, and pinch off the head. We just did that with the El Portal fire at about 5,000 acres.
But unlike the El Portal, the Rim Fire could not be contained early on. On day three, Scout ordered firefighting crews out of the canyon.
When the fire jumps the river and starts racing up the other side, the best you can do is pull the crews back, redeploy them to defend structures and communities.
The next day, the fire took a turn even further for the worse by doubling in size to over 90,000 acres. On day five, Scow knew the fire was out of control.
It was about 5 in the morning, and I got a text from the incident commander of the fire size. And when it went over 100,000 acres, I knew we were kind of getting into new territory here. This was going to be a long-duration marathon kind of firefight.
Scow called in reinforcements, and they came from as far as New Jersey. At this point, it seemed like the whole world knew about the Rim Fire. Sky News reports.
It has now burned almost 300 square miles of the rugged and wild Sierra Nevada mountains, one of the biggest and hottest they've ever seen.
The rest is history. But now, a year later, skeptics still aren't sure if the fire was handled with full force from the get-go. Filled with questions, Tuolumne County officials requested a congressional hearing into the fire and an independent investigation by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, apart from the Forest Service's original investigation.
We want people to be questioned under oath, and we want the truth.
That's Evan Royce, the chairman of the Tuolumne County Board of Supervisors. The group originally wanted to know who caused the fire, questioned how the blaze was fought, and the way the forest was managed before the fire took place.
The ground attack at night, I think, was lacking. During the day, I think they had forces there, but because of the risks, they weren't really going in, which is understandable. But at night is when they should have been attacking in.
He's not the only one doubting. Randy Hanbell, also with the county, wants answers. One of the things he wants to know is why the gallons of retardant dropped by aircraft on the third day were dramatically less than on the second. A drop from about 65,000 gallons to 23,000.
We've sent letters to the Department of Agriculture and asked them what's going on, what happened. We had a whole list of questions. The answer we got back was not satisfactory, so we sent another letter, and we've not heard a response to that one.
But Chris Scow, the fire chief for Stanislaw, says the decrease in fire retardant on the third day was because resources were used for other fires raging at the same time. Scow says a network of fire personnel fought the blaze in the best way they knew how. As the fire grew unmanageable, they resorted to protecting lives and property. He also points out that no one died fighting the fire.
The people that I work with, both in the Forest Service and in CAL FIRE, they know their job. They know how to assess a fire. They know how to keep their people safe. They know how to attack these things in a way that keeps our communities safe.
A few months after the fire, the local paper, the Union Democrat, interviewed Jim Dunn. The retired CAL FIRE air tanker pilot told the paper that he and his partner helped in the firefight, but were grounded twice early on. This sparked controversy in the community, but left officials bewildered.
I don't think Jim ever meant to imply that there was ever a direction from the Forest Service or from CAL FIRE or anybody to stand down any aviation resources. If anybody knows, it's me. I was there the whole time, and nobody said we're not using CAL FIRE aircraft ever.
Despite the controversy behind how the fire was fought and the fact that the Rim Fire was ignited by hand, wildfire experts say blazes like this will no longer be a rarity. Kelly Martin is the Chief of Fire and Aviation Management at Yosemite National Park.
I do believe that in the future, we're going to see more smoky skies.
Martin says forests in the region historically burn every 10 years, but many parts haven't caught fire for 50 years or more.
There's just so much vegetation out there and lack of fire, lack of prescribed fire, lack of natural fire, that a lot of this vegetation is completely prime for fire to help it reset.
But until we get our forests in order, the possibility of seeing a column of smoke billowing in the distance is troublingly high.
With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Diana Aguilera.
You can find an interactive timeline of the major events of the Rim Fire on our website at kvpr.org and see photos and more from our months-long investigation. We now turn our attention to the aftermath of the fire and the communities left behind in the wake of one of the largest blazes ever recorded in California. Ezra David Romero and Carrie Klein report on the community of Groveland and how the region has recovered.
9 months after the Rim Fire tore through the nearby forest, Kevin Reynolds and Randy Jones decided to live out a dream.
We kind of wanted to rise from the ashes just to kind of let people know there are still opportunities out there.
The two of them opened an old-fashioned meat market they had envisioned before the fire hit. Instead of being scared by the fire, the couple says they were inspired.
The fire didn't really affect our decision to open a meat market. We knew that, you know, there was maybe some issues, but people still need to eat.
Highway 120 into Yosemite National Park at one point is downtown Groveland. It's lined with restaurants, hotels, and mom-and-pop shops that depend on tourist traffic to stay alive.
When the blaze hit, the tourists left. Any other community could have been devastated, but Groveland stood strong.
It's partly because people like Lydia Berwick stayed and kept serving lattes at Mountain Sage Cafe.
This whole season last year, I saw, you know, life, and then once the fire happened, just gone. The fear was, what about next year? Are people going to still want to come when part of the forest is destroyed?
She remembers what it was like when the fire hit.
It was mass chaos. The previous night, we had seen the canyon, and it was just, it looked like Mordor.
Berwick isn't the only one who stayed. Saul Gonzalez owns Cocina Michoacan, a Mexican restaurant just down the street from the cafe. He says the fire came within 100 yards of his home.
It was scary. Good thing we have a second home in Sonora, so we moved down there. We never closed the restaurant.
When the flames blew towards town, Ann Schaefer saw clients empty out of her four bed and breakfasts.
Oh, well, they did, of course, eventually cancel, and the cancellations were replaced by the reporters. After the reporters left, then it was a difficult time.
But it wasn't only her business that she was afraid she'd lose. She pointed to her ranch on a map of the burned area.
Do you see how close it was?
Yeah, you're really close, 2 miles.
Yeah, two miles from the fire. So when it went around like this, I breathed a real sigh of relief.
After the worst was over and the air cleared a little, Groveland was hit by another disaster, the federal government shutdown, which closed national parks like Yosemite and again kept traffic out of town.
That's when it hit home that no matter how much the residents rely on out-of-town guests, they still have each other. Once again, Kevin Reynolds.
People are going to go out and support somebody that's trying to build something after there's been such a, you know, a horrible situation like that.
This community that's standing together recognizes they only have so much control over their livelihoods. Ann Schaefer has been in the bed and breakfast business since 2002.
In Groveland, you just realize you're part of nature. We are hardy people. We just take what comes, and actually we probably live with nature better than most.
As the town comes back to life this summer and into the fall, residents say they will always be aware the next big fire could just be a canyon away.
With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Ezra David Romero.
You can find all of our Rimfire pieces on our website at kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Edition. The saying goes that whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting over. But a California legislature that rarely shies away from a fight found itself in near unanimous agreement last week on a new water bond to replace the $11 billion measure already on the November ballot. Ben Adler has more from Sacramento.
It was an issue that held the Capitol in suspense day after day. A deal was in doubt even into yesterday afternoon, and a key election deadline loomed at midnight. But the end was surprisingly anticlimactic.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. SB 866 is supported by a host of stakeholders.
This was the entire Assembly water bond debate last night.
And labor leaders, I ask for your support.
No discussion and no debate. The clerk will open the roll. All members vote who desire to vote. All members vote who desire to vote.
The Senate took a little longer.
And let's talk a little bit of history.
Well, a lot longer, actually. But the legislation passed unanimously in the Senate and with just two no votes in the Assembly. Before the vote, Democratic Assembly Speaker Tony Atkins predicted broad support because of how the agreement was shaped.
I think there have been times in the previous bond, and as we started discussions about this bond, that it's all about counting votes and that we leave, you know, maybe there will be segments of the state that we don't accommodate. We didn't do that here.
The new bond is $7.5 billion. It includes money for groundwater sustainability, safe drinking water, and ecosystem restoration. Most importantly to Republicans and Central Valley Democrats, it contains $2.7 billion for a San Joaquin River dam and a Colusa County reservoir. That's less than the $3 billion they held out for, but Senate Minority Leader Bob Huff said it's enough to claim victory.
Well, at the end of the day, we said if it's $3 billion or $2.5 billion, we need to have somebody articulate that we can actually build these projects with this money. And the local water agencies were comfortable with this level, and that gave us the ability to go ahead with it.
The other big sticking point was winning support from lawmakers who represent the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. To do that, the bill attempts to address fears that parts of the bond could boost Governor Brown's proposal to build twin tunnels underneath the Delta that would pump water to central and southern California. Democratic Senator Lois Wolk declared the deal helps everyone and hurts no one.
I am very comfortable with the fact that this bond is tunnel neutral and does not facilitate the construction, the mitigation, or the funding for the tunnels.
Some environment and Delta groups strongly disagree, though, and say they'll work to defeat it in November. The Sierra Club says the bond would needlessly encourage dams at the expense of the environment. After the bill passed, the governor and lawmakers took a victory lap through the Capitol. Brown met privately with senators and assembly members. Then everyone gathered in his office for a signing ceremony.
Where Senator Wolk needs to get in the picture. Right in here.
Dozens of lawmakers jostled for prime positions near the governor, who promised to campaign for the measure in the fall election.
We've got a real water bond, and we've got Democrats and Republicans that are more unified than I've ever seen, probably in my life. So with that,
right. Yeah.
Brown signed the bill, which, thanks to a little legislative politics, will be Proposition 1 on the November ballot. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Healthcare advocates are concerned about a California law that allows the state to claim assets of deceased people who received health care through Medi-Cal. And as healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone in Sacramento explains, a bill moving through the California legislature would change the law.
Anne Louise Vernon had been looking forward to signing up for health insurance under Covered California. She hoped to save hundreds of dollars a month. But when she called to enroll, she was told her income wasn't high enough to purchase a subsidized plan.
It never even occurred to me I might be on Medi-Cal, and I didn't know anything about it. And I said, is there anything else I need to know that's not obvious? Are there any strings attached? And the woman very cheerfully said, oh, no, it's all free. There's nothing you have to worry about. This is your lucky day.
Vernon signed up for Medi-Cal on the phone from her home in Campbell. Just months later, she learned online about a state law that allows California to take assets of people who die if they've received health care through Medi-Cal after the age of 55.
So I called Medi-Cal and ask specifically, does this mean what I think it means?
It means Medi-Cal managers can take part of her estate later for health care costs she's accruing now. Federal law requires states to recoup Medicaid money spent on institutional care, such as nursing homes. But California also seizes assets for state spending on basic health services. Vernon says she's panicked and worried. She doesn't get a monthly bill, so she's not sure what she'll be accountable for.
I feel as though right now, if I could go to the doctor and I felt that I knew where I stood, there are a number of appointments I'd be making right now, but I feel so unsettled about this whole estate recovery thing that I'm afraid to go to the doctor.
The California law has been on the books for two decades. Elizabeth Landsberg of the Western Center on Law and Poverty says it turns what was intended to be a safety net program into a long-term loan program. And it undermines the security that families might pass on to the next generation.
So in most cases, it's modest family homes that we're talking about. And so the state will most often come back and put a lien on that home. And unfortunately, it does force the kids to sell the home sometimes.
Landsberg says the law is complicating Medi-Cal enrollment. Some people have refused to sign up or have terminated enrollment for fear of losing their estate. She says it's unfair because people buying insurance through Covered California aren't subject to the same rules.
For the first time, people have to have health coverage. So it's created an inequity where the lowest income people could lose their assets. And other higher income people who are also getting publicly subsidized health coverage have no worries.
Over the past 20 years, the state of California has recovered almost $1 billion that paid for long-term care and basic health services through Medi-Cal. Norman Williams of the California Department of Healthcare Services says that's just a very small fraction of the overall Medi-Cal budget during that time.
The funds are collected and returned to the state general fund, and along with federal matching funds, that's used to provide care for members beyond what we have now.
Williams says the average claim is about $95,000.
But the average amount collected is only $15,000. There are many exceptions available, hardship exemptions, for instance. If there are children who are living and under 21, there is no claim against the Medi-Cal member's estate.
A bill in the California legislature would eliminate state recovery for basic Medi-Cal services for older Californians. It would also require the state to provide health claim information for free so enrollees can keep track of their expenses. That's something Anne Louise Vernon is advocating for.
I don't understand why someone my age, in my situation, has been singled out to be a cash cow for the state of California when this is not required by the federal government.
If the measure is approved by lawmakers, it might have a tough time getting the governor's signature. The California Department of Finance says it would remove $30 million that helps pay for the health care of other low-income Californians. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and learn more about a program in Firebaugh that's bringing kids to the river and teaching them healthy lifestyles and a healthy respect for the water of the San Joaquin. That and the latest in the ongoing fight over health care for undocumented residents in Fresno County. It's coming to a boiling point today at the Board of Supervisors. We'll have a report. That and life as a cow in Central California. Joe Matthews of Zocalo Public Square joins us. He says you have more in common with your bovine friends than you might think. All that and more, all on the way on Valley Edition here on Valley Public Radio.
Be a lady tonight.
Hey, Skeets, you hear about this FM89 drawing for 10 G's? Only 60 clams. Take some of that dough you earn at the candy store and get on it. You dig?
Tickets are now available for Valley Public Radio's $10,000 drawing. Your $60 ticket purchase gives you a chance to win $10,000. Call for tickets at 800-275-0764.
Listening to Valley Edition, the San Joaquin River begins high in the Sierra Nevada, flows through the foothills and into the valley. By the time it reaches many of the small towns in the region, the water from the river has been used multiple times. But as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, a new use for the river has been found in one of the unlikeliest of places.
Cannonball! That's the sound of kids playing and jumping into the San Joaquin River in the rural west side town of Firebaugh.
1, 2, 3.
There at River Camp, sponsored by the San Joaquin River Parkway and Conservation Trust. 3 years ago, the organization planted the camp in Firebaugh with the hope to change the perception of the river and the health of the community. River Camp Director Juana Chavarria remembers year one.
I would ask the kids, have you guys been down here? Like, they didn't even know there was a park down here. They didn't know a river that was down here.
The small agricultural community of Firebaugh is one of the oldest historical towns on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. The kids at the camp are primarily the children of farm laborers and farmers. They learn all about the history and ecosystem of the river, are taught safety skills, and some kids even learn how to swim. But Firebaugh Dr. Marsha Sablon says the camp is changing the minds of the town's residents, one child, then one family at a time. She says the community has had trouble trusting a river that at one time was known more for people drowning, river dumping, and fear than fun.
Every year you hear a person drowning in that area. It seems like people haven't had access to water and they really don't know how to swim.
Chavarria says Hispanic culture is part of the problem.
Our tradition and our culture holds the rivers dangerous. Some things we cannot do, they're going to get you in trouble.
Sablon takes this a step further and points to regional folklore.
In a lot of the Hispanic culture, there's fear of ghosts living in the river.
But the camp is demystifying superstition and unspoken rules in the community. Meet 11-year-old Jenny Silva.
Its name is called the San Joaquin River. There used to be a bridge, but it destroyed.
This is her third time attending river camp. She says without it, she'd be stuck indoors for all summer vacation.
It feels better to be outside than inside because you just feel like you're in a cage.
Does that make you sad?
Well, yeah, because I would be bored, not really nothing to do.
Silva says she can't wait until next year for the guided nature walks.
You guys want to learn about the river and the animals and stuff
like
that?
Yeah. And reptiles.
This program was modeled in Fresno and then taken to Fireball. Sablon, the doctor who practices in the town, says Fireball is afflicted with diabetes, high blood pressure, and obesity. She prescribes outdoor activity to her patients regularly.
I think I ask every single person when they have their physical how much exercise they're getting. Probably one out of three of adults either have diabetes or are at a risk.
Sablon says River Camp is making the rural town healthier by targeting children and getting them active. She even drops her grandkids off at the camp.
It's just been an eye-opener for many of the kids at Fireball who haven't ever, first of all, swam in the river, and secondly, even been that close to it.
But that's all changed for them. Now that they know what the San Joaquin has to offer, like tadpoles, they can come and play safely in the river whenever their parents let them.
I got a bunch in one.
Reporting from the San Joaquin River in Fireball, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This story is part of a Valley Public Radio series on how the health of rivers impacts the health of communities, produced as a project for the California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowship, a program of USC's Annenberg School of Journalism. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. There's a near constant tension in this part of California over our main industry, agriculture. And it's not just about the lack of water for Valley farmers or the impact that high-speed rail might have on Valley agricultural operations. Instead, it's about something far greater. Those who do the work in the fields and make our ag economy possible here in Central California are also, by and large, here illegally. Throw in an issue as controversial as health care, and those tensions come to the surface in new and unexpected ways. It's a debate that's been brewing over the past year over the fate of a Fresno County program that for the past three decades has provided specialty health care services to undocumented residents living in the county. It's an issue that's found the county and health care advocates on opposite sides of a courtroom fight, and one that today includes a public hearing about the fate of the program. FM89's Diana Aguilera reports on the latest development in this saga, a few lines in the state budget agreement that could help the county save the program for the next year, if it so chooses.
Juana Paredes is a farm worker who lives in Fresno. A couple days ago, she took her daughter and niece with her to the Mosqueda Community Center and joined others in a rally to stop Fresno County from dismantling a program that offers health care to undocumented residents.
La salud es un derecho humano.
Sitting in the front row, Paredes says she showed up because she has a clear message to Fresno County: continue health care services for the undocumented.
The people that are thinking of excluding undocumented should think twice, because there are many undocumented families and many kids who need the program.
After 30 years, Fresno County may no longer provide specialty care for undocumented residents through its Medically Indigent Service Program. Paredes says if that's the case, she wouldn't know where to turn for help.
Oh no, that means I would no longer have help when it comes to my health.
Last year, the county asked a judge to dissolve an order from 1984 that requires the county to provide health care services for its undocumented population. Officials say they simply can't afford to continue the services because of health funding cuts from the state. And in April, a judge ruled that the county is no longer required to offer these services to the undocumented. County officials say an estimated 6,000 people who are undocumented currently use these services. Now, Assemblymember Henry T. Perea, who represents Fresno, is offering the county a possible short-term solution. Perea negotiated a deal to defer the county's payment of $5.5 million for road funds to the state, but with some strings attached.
What we did in the budget is said, okay, look, the state will defer county's payment of that $5 million for the next 5 years. What we want is for 1 year for the county to use those funds to continue the MISP program so that the underserved can continue to receive health care.
He says these funds would cover the gap when it comes to specialty care, such as cancer treatment or other critical needs.
An undocumented farm worker goes to the emergency room and it turns out that this farm worker has a serious issue that needs to be dealt with, a medical issue. The specialty care funds are there to help offset those medical costs.
Now the county has to figure out the next step. Later today, the county will look at two options. They could either accept the money and leave the program as it is, or they could reject the $5.5 million, leaving undocumented residents out on the street without specialty health care. If the county does change the eligibility of the program, It would allow the county to end its long-running contract with Community Regional Medical Center. It works something like this. The county pays the hospital a fixed amount of about $21 million per year. And the hospital says the program costs much more than that. According to county officials, Assemblymember Perea's deal doesn't provide enough money to continue these services. The annual cost of providing program services to the undocumented through the hospital could cost up to $30 million. I contacted the offices of all five county supervisors. The only supervisor who agreed to talk was Assemblymember Perea's father, Supervisor Henry Perea. He says the county should accept the deal.
In my head, it should be an easy one. You know, let's take the money and let's provide health care like we should be.
Supervisor Perea says a person's immigration status shouldn't be used to exclude people from receiving any type of health care.
When people get sick, you can't turn your backs on them. To me, it's just a fundamental right of human rights, doing the right thing by people, and not taking advantage of them and thinking they don't exist.
Activist Sandra Celedon Castro with Building Healthy Communities says Fresno County should take the offer.
We hope again that the board has heard the message loud and clear from the community, from over 1,000 folks that have spoken to them at one point or another, that are urging them to, one, take the $5.5 million, and two, continue the program and extend it to undocumented Fresnans so that we all have health care.
Castro points out that the supervisors in their chamber have a huge banner highlighting the wealth that agriculture brings into the region.
It's really hypocritical to say we care about farm workers and we care about farmers, but not when it comes to their health.
Supervisor Perea is against eliminating health care services to the undocumented. He says if the county were to accept the agreement, its obligation to continue services is only until that money runs out.
There are some people that are saying this $5 million really isn't $5 million. It's going to be a $5 million obligation that we're going to have for the next 5 years.
He says that's not the case.
Our job is making sure that supervisors that are going to make the decision understand the fact that, no, this is $5.5 million, one-time use money. We're going to use it till it runs out. Hopefully it'll last at least a year while we figure out the long-term solution.
Assemblymember Perea says they're debating a possible solution at the state level, but nothing is guaranteed.
In the event something doesn't move forward statewide, then we have to take a hard look at what we can do locally.
Juana Paredes, the farm worker in Fresno, is a bit nervous about the future.
The undocumented people are the ones that suffer the most because we don't have papers. We often don't go to the doctor.
She says the undocumented community needs to stay strong.
We all need to unite.
The Fresno County Board of Supervisors is scheduled to discuss this topic and hold a public hearing later today. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Diana Aguilera.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Here's a question for you. How much do you have in common with a California dairy cow? Well, Joe Matthews of Zocalo Public Square says it might be more than you think. He joins us now on the phone to talk about his latest column about the dairy industry. Joe, welcome.
Thank you.
You write that Californians have more in common with the Valley's dairy cows than they might realize. How is that?
Well, you know, recent history, both in the state as a whole and in the dairy industry, is similar. You know, at the same time, the state and people in it were being hurt by the recession, by the housing crisis. You know, it was a sort of 1929 experience for a lot of people in the dairy industry. You know, they got hit hard. You know, about 25% fewer dairies now than there were in 2006. The combination of drop in prices for milk with a run-up in the costs of feed really, really hurt a lot of people. Folks had a fair amount of debt, and a lot of people got hurt.
And just like the rest of the state, in some ways, that industry has rebounded, as you write.
That's certainly true. It's come back. Prices have gone up. Exports are really strong. You know, our competitors overseas in places like Europe and especially New Zealand have not done as well. But, you know, I think the other thing that's happening is even though we're doing better, and I think, you know, we human Californians feel this just as, you know, cows might, we're all being asked to do more with less. So while there's this sense that, you know, we're doing better, we're out of the worst, you know, dairies have to be much more productive with fewer animals. Much more efficient, and it can feel a lot like, I don't know if it's true for you, it sometimes feels like, for me in journalism, you know, doing more, doing better, but still not quite getting ahead, and not quite certain of what the future is. And I think that's true for a lot of people in all kinds of different industries in California, and it's certainly true in the dairy business.
And you talk about that, about the future being uncertain and California's leadership being uncertain. I want to go back to that. But first, I thought it was interesting that you were writing this column, and not only writing it from the perspective of a bovine resident of the state, but the dairy industry isn't something that most people, I think, in at least the big urban centers or even here in the Central Valley, if you live in a city, really give much thought to, other than when you drive past on Highway 99 or Interstate 5 and maybe see it or maybe smell the industry. You write that in the stories and headlines, cows are usually invoked as symbols of the past, the epitome of the traditional way of life. This, maybe talk about what made you write this piece and the way that urban California thinks of this industry or doesn't think of it.
Well, I'm one of those folks. I'm an urban Southern Californian from here, from L.A., been here most of my life. And, you know, I've got relatives all over state and been driving up the 5 and the 99 all my life. And, you know, seen the sheds, seen the cows. And I've been spending more time since I began writing this column a couple years ago in the San Joaquin Valley. And I've been to a couple dairies in Kings County and Tulare County in particular. And, you know, I was in Tulare a couple months back and, you know, was sort of in a stare down with a dairy cow. And, you know, as journalists are, you know, wonder what she's thinking. what could she tell me if she could? And, you know, I mean, she didn't consent to an interview. You know, these cows, they don't return calls. They're worse than people in Hollywood. And so I, you know, I gave myself a license to try to imagine what a cow might see and say after spending some time talking to people who are around cows and are at dairies. And I'm very nervous about the call. I'm not sure I pull it off quite right, but sometimes you got to try things that are a little bit different. And I chose to write this way because I thought it might be easier to understand and digest the information, particularly for people who know nothing about this, if they could kind of see it from another perspective.
I think you did a fine job. You have a way of taking topics that people don't often think about or a perspective that people often don't think of and presenting them in a new way. I'm not sure if you're aware, but this dairy boom that we have seen recently made headlines in another way in Fresno County. Is for years, Fresno has been considered or has been ranked as the number one agricultural county, not only in the state, but in the nation in terms of crop value. But for this year, partly due to the drought and partly due to the increase in the value of the dairy industry and milk prices, Tulare County, for the first time, at least in first time in anyone's recent memory, eclipsed Fresno County in its overall crop value. The drought plays a role in this, and other things are also happening as well as dairy land begins to, in some cases, be developed for other purposes.
No, that's true, and I thought about including a little Tulare trash talk since I imagine my cow being a Tulare cow, but, you know, there was a limited space. I mean, there is a lot of change. I mean, I think there is a sense that the agriculture never changes. When I covered Governor Schwarzenegger, he used to say, we got to do something for the farms and ranches and the like because they can't move. Well, that's not true. It turns out, you know, this is a pretty dynamic business. It's changed a lot. You know, dairymen have left to places like Colorado and Utah. And, you know, the governor of South Dakota, you know, made a trip to Tulare not so long ago to try to recruit people. It's a very dynamic, fast-changing industry. I mean, the thing I see, you know, as a visitor to the Valley is it does sort of feel like the nuts are taking over to me. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. Crazy, I mean the actual nuts, the almonds, and you know, to lesser extent, the pistachios, the walnuts, the olives are doing pretty well too. I mean, the trees, you know, more present in places where I'm used to seeing other kinds of crops. So that's a big difference. And I think, you know, while the dairies you mentioned are doing well, milk prices are up. I do wonder if that can last. There's less land for feed. There's less land for dairies. Is it as profitable a business as the nut business? I'm told not. In the long run, you know, could the dairies go someplace else? I mean, that wouldn't be the strangest thing that happened. You know, a couple generations ago, you know, a lot of the dairies in California were in the Inland Empire. So, You know, there's a lot of change, you know, as much change in this business as there is in Silicon Valley in many ways, but we don't quite appreciate it.
Is that another way that the fate of this industry that may be overlooked by a lot of residents of the state mirrors the rest of California? You have Governor Rick Perry going throughout the state touting his efforts to steal California companies to the Lone Star State, and you have similar things in the dairy industry. I know Nevada has put a big push on trying to get dairies to move there as well. California dairies also have to deal with a lot more regulatory issues, and the air quality concerns have certainly been only growing here in the Central Valley when it comes to the environmental impacts of dairy operations.
I think in all the ways you mentioned and more, it's getting harder. It's getting harder for Californians, whether they're, you know, they're cows or computer programmers or, you know, folks working behind, you know, below the line, as they say in Hollywood, is, you know, on makeup and, you know, technical jobs. It's harder to make it here. Things are more complicated, you know, and that and the pressures of not just competition from other states or globally, but of technology, the way it's changed us. I mean, even, you know, cows have been profoundly changed by technology, particularly advances in genetics. I learned a lot in the course of reporting this about sexed semen and that advance nearly a decade ago, which allows when you're breeding cows, you can separate the semen that's going to make girl babies from boy babies, and that means you get a lot of cows. So there's, you know, that means the life cycle of dairy cows is less. There's always sort of younger and fresher cows producing more milk. That's the goal. You know, it's sort of, you know, it's like being a billionaire's wife. You have to, you know, it always seems like there's a younger female around if you're a cow looking to take your place. So, you know, I mean, the pressure on all sorts of Californians is just super intense. And the trend suggests it's just going to be greater. It's getting harder and harder to make it here.
You can find Joe Matthews' column on our website at kvpr.org. It's called We Are All Dairy Cows Now. Joe Matthews writes for Zocalo Public Square. Joe Matthews, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. This weekend marks Fresno's biggest party of the year. The 54th annual Greek Festival returns Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at St. George Greek Orthodox Church. Here to join us now and tell us more about the event, we have Peter Vallis. He is the chairman of the Fresno Greek Festival. Peter, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
This has to be Fresno's biggest party of the year, is it not?
If it isn't, I'd be stunned.
It might have a rival in some of the big football tailgates, but I think that Greek Fest over 3 days probably takes the cake. This is the 54th year of this event that has become a tradition and a very popular thing, not just for members of the Greek community, but really for members of the general public who want to get a little bit of taste, literally, of Greek culture.
That's exactly right. You know, there are no Greek restaurants in Fresno. And there really aren't that many Greeks. And so this is the one time a year where Fresno gets to experience and eat the stuff that you otherwise have to fly all the way to Greece to get. And it's a real neat thing to be able to host, you know, upwards of 25,000 hungry Fresnans on an annual basis.
The interesting thing here is a lot of the things that are on the menu at Greek Fest are things that even members of the Greek community, as I understand it, don't eat all the time.
No, we'd get really fat. And, you know, none of these are really low-calorie items except for, you know, salad and some of the grilled meats.
So whet our appetite here a little bit. What can we look forward to on the menu at Greek Fest this weekend?
Well, we've got lamb shanks, which are particularly good, and we sell out of those every year. And then we have the world-famous moussaka, which is layers of eggplant, meat, some potato with about an inch and a half thick bechamel on top. And then its cousin, pasticcio, which is the Greek version of lasagna, which is like lasagna but also covered in bechamel. We have all sorts of forms of lamb. We have lamb chops, lamb skewers, pork skewers, chicken skewers, gyro sandwiches, which are ubiquitous all over Greece with our homemade tzatziki. Naturally, we have all of our pastries. We make about 30,000 pastries. Now, those, we don't get those all the time. We may get one or two, But the array of which we have at the festival, we bust those out for weddings and other fun events, much like having 25,000 people over for dinner.
Have you seen the event grow over the years? Because it's really become quite popular.
You know what? I remember when I was a little kid, it seemed really big. And now as an adult, it just keeps getting bigger. And that's really kind of a testament, I think, to two things. One, to the embrace of the multiculturalism that we have here in the Valley and the love of the people to explore and discover that. And also, I think it talks to the heritage of the Greek people, where playing host is an integral part of our background. And it's a great way, if you want to get to know what being Greek is to experience the hospitality of going to a Greek's house.
So every year with the festival, I imagine you try to do something a little bit different. What's new for the 54th edition of Greek Fest in Fresno?
Well, this year we've been listening to the people coming saying, you know, it's kind of crowded and the lines are a little long, and we understand that. And so we're trying a couple things this year to make that a better experience for the festival goer. We have one entrance and we have one exit, so hopefully people can flow through the event better. And then we've rearranged some of our more popular food items to hopefully serve people in a faster way, so people can get from standing in line to sitting and gorging themselves in a faster and more efficient way.
Now, with all of the food that's cooked, are the preparations already underway right now? What's happening in kitchens throughout the members of the congregation?
Actually, that's kind of a misnomer. It's not little old ladies making a pan of this or a pan of that and bringing it over to the church. We actually have a somewhat commercial kitchen. It's made sure it's cleaned by the health department and everything else, and it's certified. And we start cooking in June, and we start preparing things. And right now we finished making everything yesterday. There are a couple more things. We have some hummus to make and we have some tzatziki to mix. But really from this point out, it's cooking, grilling, and serving.
I understand you also have a rather humorous local politician who is not afraid of poking fun of himself to be a part of the event.
That's exactly right. In addition to the plethora of activities for kids, water slides, where we even recycle the water since it is a drought, gold panning, our county assessor, Paul Dictos, has volunteered that for anyone upset about their property taxes, for $5 you can dunk the assessor on Friday, Saturday, and Saturday night. And we're anticipating that to be a very popular attraction this year.
I can see this becoming a very popular thing for politicians throughout the Central Valley as well. What else can people expect, and where can people get tickets to Greek Fest?
Well, you can show up and get tickets, but we highly recommend you go to our website, www.fresnogreekfest.com, where we do run a special. If you buy online, it's $1 less to get in. And that just helps to get people in the door faster. It's a print-at-home ticket. We scan it when you come in. And you can expect, with the weather the way it's going to be this weekend, a very lovely either afternoon or evening, depending on when you want to come. There's a lot of shopping. We have a fantastic band coming up from Long Beach, as they have the last several years. And one of the things that keeps them coming back to Fresno in August, because there are other options in the West they could go to, is that they just love playing to the crowd that shows up. And Fresno, as much as we love having everyone, really seems to enjoy the party.
The 54th annual Greek Fest taking place Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday morning and afternoon at St. George Greek Orthodox Church in Fresno. We've been talking with Peter Vallis. He's the chairman of Fresno Greek Fest. Again, Peter, thank you so much for stopping by and wish you the best this year.
Thank you, Joe.
All right. Does it for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org or follow us on Twitter. We're @KVPR. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.